Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust way back in 2002. We've been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans, and we're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, Sue Jones talks to a daughter of a British diplomat turned journalist, Vanessa Bealey, down in Frome. Then Sue gives us some valuable advice about strokes from having to wait 30 minutes for an ambulance recently. Then Rich Nyland. He's part of the Brain Drain, this time from the USA to Germany, and he works in precision medical instruments. But what's his take on the election campaign and the coming era of Trump? Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, prsc.org.uk. You can also contact Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Online, that's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or the national do-it.org. And I'll repeat those details at the end of the show. OK, over to you, Sue.
Hi, Tony. Right, well, I went to a talk in Frome and Vanessa Bealey was speaking. Now, she's an independent investigative journalist and her father was a special envoy to Egypt in the Suez crisis a long time ago. So she's grown up and known about the Middle East and takes a big interest in it. She was a member of the United States peace mission to Syria, and she's been quoted by UN representatives, so she is respected. And the reason that I talked to her is she's just come back from a four-week stay in Syria, and she says that things are quite different to how they're portrayed in our media.
The propaganda war that has been waged against Syria and the Syrian people for the last 5.5 years is probably one of the most insidious and heavyweight propaganda wars that we've ever seen. Commensurate with the 5.5 years, the extent to which the Syrian state, the Syrian army and her allies and the Syrian people have resisted NATO state, US coalition, Gulf state, Israeli, Turkish intervention, illegal intervention into a sovereign nation via proxy military forces, i.e. the various factions of terrorists that are occupying Syria, have invaded Syria and continue to invade Syria through the porous Turkish borders. The destruction and decimation that you see inside Syria, particularly, for instance, at the moment in Aleppo, is as a result of this illegal NATO war that is being waged against a sovereign nation, i.e. Syria, and against an elected government. The majority of the Syrian people, according to any polls globally, even inside the headquarters of one of its most virulent enemies inside Qatar, in Doha, has shown President Bashar al-Assad to have a clear lead in the popularity contest inside Syria, even during the most heated of conflict inside Syria. He still maintained his popularity, and his popularity now has extended even beyond that. And so for me, what the Syrian state has to do to cleanse itself of this invasion of various mercenary, militant, terrorist factions at the behest of NATO states and its allies is contributing to the decimation of the country of Syria, but it would not be happening were our governments not invading this sovereign state.
Why do you think our governments are invading the Syrian state? What have we got to gain out of it?
Well, all of the nations within this criminal coalition that are targeting Syria for regime change have made it quite clear publicly through public declarations that their agenda is regime change. And the reasons behind that is that Syria is a strong, independent, largely socialist nation, adhering to clear socialist principles which immediately threaten our pseudo-democratic governments in the West. And Equally, of course, particularly the UK, France, the United States are protecting the interests of their number one ally, their military base in the Middle East, which is Israel. Israel is the major beneficiary of the perpetual conflict and chaos inside Syria. It's the major beneficiary of a weakened Syria as a country, but both as a country and as a government. Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador, made it very clear that he would prefer ISIS to be in power to President Assad.
Why?
Because for Israel, Syria is its number one strongest enemy in the region. There is the ongoing dispute over the Golan Heights, over the oil interests in the Golan Heights and the territory that Israel has illegally taken occupied. So there are many agendas there for Israel. And of course, Syria is a supporter and also a home to Hezbollah, whose very purpose is the freedom of Palestine and the destruction of the illegal Israeli state. So it's a natural inclination for Israel to want Syria in a weakened state, in a partitioned state, in a sectarian partitioned state, in order to maintain the perpetual conflict inside Syria, to remove a strong leadership, a strong government, a well-supported government, both by Iran, by Russia, Iran, who is a... the number one enemy, if you like, and obviously the supporter of Hezbollah for Israel. So, you know, it's a very clear agenda for Israel, which is being supported particularly by the UK, who has huge interest to maintain its support with Israel. France, the same. And, of course, the United States. We know about the symbiotic relationship between Israel and the United States.
So this view of things that you've got, that you're evidencing by your trips out to Syria, is not coming through on the mainstream media at all, is it? Not even in newspapers like The Guardian or whatever?
We're starting to see some fracturing of their NATO-aligned narrative recently. There's been a recent mass visit by the mainstream media, both from the United States and from the UK, into West and slightly infringing into East Aleppo, some of the liberated areas that have been very recently liberated by the Syrian Arab Army. And it's proving to be very hard for them to maintain this NATO-aligned narrative. And so we're seeing a little few chinks in their propaganda armor, let's say, but they're still trying to twist and distort that narrative around to being in lockstep with the state narrative, which, as we know, their agenda and objective is regime change and a no-fly zone in Syria, which means basically we bomb, you don't zone. And we know from history has reduced Libya, for example, down to failed state level. And that's the intention equally inside Syria, were they to achieve this no-fly zone.
One thing that's come up recently is the White Helmets, which have been recently nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, though they didn't get it. Now, they're seen as sort of selfless heroes, volunteers from all over Syria who dig people out of the rubble, 60,000 people so far, and good guys, basically. But that's not the way you see it.
Certainly not. This organisation is a terrorist-linked, multi-million NATO state-funded so-called NGO. It was established not in Syria, it was established in Gaziantep in Turkey, and it was established by an ex-military British mercenary intelligence officer who has functioned on behalf of British intelligence in their various intervention projects across Europe and the Middle East. It was set up in 2013. As I say, it is multi-million funded by primarily the UK, who so far to date has, we believe, given over 65 million of taxpayers' money to this organisation. USAID, which we know to be an outreach agent for American intelligence to lead towards regime change or infiltration of target nations. They've funded it to the tune of 23 million. France, Denmark, Holland, Germany have contributed. Japan, has contributed, and now we see one of the most publicly declared financiers of the terrorist groups inside Syria also now taking over funding or taking on funding of the White Helmets. But the very important point to make here is that the White Helmets, multi-million funded by our own governments who are intent upon regime change, so have a very clear vested interest inside Syria and declared interest, these operatives are embedded exclusively in ISIS and al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda affiliate inside Syria areas. They do not operate outside those areas. And the other important point to make, there is an existing Syria civil defense that was established in 1953. It is a member of the International Civil Defense Organization based in Geneva, and it is the only Syria civil defense that is recognized by this official body that is affiliated to the UN, to the Red Cross, to WHO, to OCHA, to Red Crescent. And this is a very important point to make. So fundamentally, this British construct is a shadow state construct that was established not inside Syria, outside Syria. It is implanted into terrorist-held areas, and it is trying to undermine and marginalize and eradicate an existing Syrian state institution, humanitarian institution, the real Syria civil defense that is working in both government and terrorist-held areas and has been in existence for over 60 years.
So the White Helmets are a sham organization.
Absolutely. They're frauds.
And they nearly got the Nobel Peace Prize, except I think yourself and some other people got in touch with the commission.
Yeah. We basically put forward a statement. In fact, the Right Livelihood Award, who had already awarded the White Helmets with their 2016 prize. So the statement that we put forward to the RLA, presenting the evidence against the White Helmets, which includes video evidence, documentary evidence, photographic evidence taken from their own social media accounts. So it's not something that we've fabricated here. It's taken from their own accounts.
And some of it shows how closely the White Helmets are to some of the terrorists who committed awful crimes, beheading a 12-year-old.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, a recent Channel 4 video that was taken down when people pointed out this fact that they were, if you like, iconizing Nur al-Din Zinki operatives. And Nur al-Din Zinki is the terrorist group, as you rightly say, that beheaded 12-year-old Abdullah Issa, the Palestinian child. We saw and were being filmed by Channel 4 White Helmet operatives running basically alongside Nur al-Din Zinki operatives. Equally, there are videos showing White Helmets beating a civilian prisoner taken by Nusra Front inside Idlib in March 2015. There is video evidence of them participating and mopping up after a Nusra execution in northern Aleppo. There's evidence of them posting videos of the torture and public execution of Syrian Arab army prisoners of war. So there are countless videos of these operatives supporting terrorist activities, supporting criminal activities, and taking part in terrorist massacres and executions.
What do you think is the future for Syria that would be the best thing that could happen to them?
Firstly, I'm not Syrian. That's not a question for me to answer, but I can tell you what the majority of Syrians would say to me, and that is for our government, for the UK government, for the entire US coalition to get the heck out of Syria, to take their proxy forces with them, to take their terrorists with them, to stop funding and arming these terrorists, and above all, to end the sanctions. Stop these crippling sanctions that are being imposed upon the Syrian people. They are collectively punishing the Syrian people. There are, despite the best efforts of the Syrian state to maintain all services to civilians inside Syria, the health sectors are suffering. There are cancer patients that are unable to get treatment and are dying as a result. What does this achieve? What does this achieve? It's a criminal action on behalf of our government. So sanctions must end immediately. And that is the first thing that all Syrians will tell you if you ask them that question inside Syria. So as I say again, it's not for me to decide the future for Syria. It's for the Syrian people to decide their own future. But we need to stop ignoring the majority of Syrian people that support their government, that want peace for their country, that do not want to kill their own country in order to achieve the reforms that they would like to see inside their own country. And they want foreign nations to stop meddling in their affairs.
So we should get the hell out.
Yes.
Thank you. So that was Vanessa Beely, who was speaking to the Frum Stop the War group, and that was on the 9th of November, which was a memorable night because it was the night that Donald Trump was elected in the States. And given the propaganda that's going on in Syria, do you think it's just Syria, Tony, that we get this propaganda? What about the American elections?
No, definitely not. I think one of the fascinating things to see is how last week, one of the first things that Donald Trump has done is gone to talk to the New York Times. He's given them a whole load of exclusives, including discussing this whole idea of Nigel Farage being the US ambassador, which of course is just a little bit of fun. But I mean, this is the sort of thing, I suppose, that the kind of more politically correct Obama administration would never dare to breathe. But it shows you that we've got a bit of a new broom in, for good or ill. But look, the most important thing to point out is that the reason I think he went to see the New York Times is because he's a little bit fed up with their propaganda. On polling day itself, that's November the 8th, just the day before you spoke to Vanessa Beely down in Frome, which was actually polling day over there, the New York Times published an in-house poll saying that the state and national polls across the United States were giving Hillary Clinton an 85% chance of winning and Donald Trump an only 15% chance of winning. So I think that was totally unrealistic. The New York Times didn't say anything about what it was actually based on, other than on their upshot page that it was an in-house poll. And I think that's why Donald Trump's chosen the New York Times to be the first place to go and, in a way, give a kind of lecture to them to say, look, I'm the president now, so none of this funny business about making up polls. And, of course, it's not just in the United States that there's big questions over polling, because another example is over in Turkey. President Erdogan has shut down the Today's Zaman newspaper back on the 4th of March. People may remember seeing scores or even hundreds of police moving into the newspaper's offices and surrounding the newspaper whilst there was a public protesting outside to shut down Today's Zaman newspaper, which is one of the biggest newspapers, certainly the biggest independent newspaper. I mean, some would say it had outside Turkey influence, you know, and money coming into it, but it was certainly independent of the government, which is quite important. To shut that down. But what you really probably haven't heard is that Today's Zaman were also the only independent polling organisation in Turkey that conducted things like exit polls at elections. So it's very important to have that as a check on whether a government is rigging an election. If you've got an independent exit poll going on at the same time, and, of course, the government in Turkey has closed that down. So there's a really enormous erosion of democratic rights going on in Turkey. And we've just heard that it looks like they might even be leaving NATO. They've been making friends with ASEAN, which is the kind of equivalent of NATO in Southeast Asia, in the Asian world. And, of course, they're seeing themselves, like in many ways the Iranians do, as more leaning towards Asia than to Europe, seeing Europe as just being a kind of puppet of America. So that's on the one hand in Turkey and the United States propaganda. But of course, the problem here is in Britain too. We get quite a lot here, particularly as Vanessa Beely was saying with Channel 4 News, being embedded with the terrorists in Aleppo and sort of doing a report as if the terrorist side is a legitimate kind of just reporting one side of the war. And actually, what Vanessa points out is that they were normalising attacks on civilians, Channel 4 News, you know, really not even questioning or criticising the terrorists for attacking civilians. And also the same with suicide bombings. So as you can see, there's a bit of bias, I think, crept into, you know, it's actually state-owned Channel 4 and Channel 4 News. It's supposed to be doing public service broadcasting. We're seeing more and more propaganda over here. When you're talking about Turkey and democracy, we've also got a serious problem here in Britain, because we've got 31 Conservative MPs who have been sitting in their constituencies in seats for the last 18 months since the general election in May 2015, where evidence has been submitted that there's been serious fraud and overspend in their election expenses. So by rights, these police should, I mean, they supposedly are, I think it's 17 different police forces looking into this, for the last year or so, and 18 months on from the general election, we still haven't had any prosecutions of any of those people who submitted those election expenses in any of those 31 Conservative constituencies. So in a way, all of the legislation that's being passed now could be illegitimate, because the Conservative majority could quite possibly not be there. But of course, we're getting polls in this country telling us that the Conservatives are anything between, some say 17, some say 5, 6% ahead. Who's to say whether those polls are correct? Because I think that it's become pretty clear that these polling organisations are seen as key organisations by the ruling party at the time and the most wealthy party at the time to try and control, because they see voters, and in a way, the behaviour echoes this, as a little bit sheep-like. So when people see that they think someone's going to win, they're more likely to vote for them if they think that they're the winners. I mean, I think it's almost a natural thing in human nature that says, well, if someone looks like a winner, I'm going to vote for them. I don't want to vote for the loser. So there is, I think, tremendous amount of manipulation going on in different parts of the world, certainly a bit here in Britain, and the potential is for even more. And all I'd say is, to sort of round up, is that the police have really got to get these prosecutions out there, or they've got to say there's nothing to see here, because the evidence is already in the public domain for many of these constituencies that there quite clearly has been overspending, which is illegal. It's a criminal offence to do this overspending, and it's fraudulent. And potentially those sitting Conservative MPs, including MP in Thornbury here in Bristol, should potentially have to have a rerun of that election. And I mean, one of the things that the Conservatives have got through in the meantime with these 31 MPs that shouldn't be there is this thing called the Snoopers Charter, which is the biggest extension of surveillance powers we've ever seen in Britain, really down to 1930s Nazi levels of ability to collect massive amount of data and store it on every member of the public, whether they've actually committed a crime or not. This includes, folks, things like your passwords to pretty much everything you've got, so they can store that data if they can collect it, which they pretty much generally can. And so I think it's probably a good idea to be very careful about your passwords and changing them regularly, being very disciplined about them, rather than just having one password for your online banking and everything else, to have a serious think about it, because the Snoopers Charter is going to bring a lot of our internet use into the world of the spooks, and the spooks at GCHQ, etc., are able, in fact, in some cases it's documented, they are basically going to big business and they're saying, what can we do for you? And of course, for many big companies, they want our data. They want to know what our habits are, whether it's spending or whatever. And it's a massive erosion of civil liberties that the Conservatives have got through with this Snoopers Charter, just about to get the royal assent. And so in a way, that is one of the biggest dangers that's come out of all of this, and the failure of the police to act on the fraud at the last general election, Sue.
Right. Serious stuff.
Well, that was a big bit of a rant, I know. But but at the end of the day, I think we're living in an Orwellian world where quite a lot of the time we're being presented with something like we heard from Vanessa in Syria, where the legitimate leader who's been elected, that is President Assad, is seen as the bad guy. Now, that's a very dangerous road to go down, because we end up supporting the terrorists.
Yes, what she did say was that the rebels there, who weren't happy with the way the president was running things, Nevertheless, they did not want a civil war. They did not want terrorist groups coming in and hijacking their cause. They wanted Syrian people to be left alone to sort it out themselves.
Well, what about, you know, in America, if the militias in America, and of course America has a lot of guns hanging around over there, decided that they didn't agree with the election of Donald Trump and started, you know, basically saying that if Donald Trump comes to Alabama or wherever it happens to be, or Texas, we're going to shoot him. You know, this is effectively what you've got in places like Syria. So I can't quite understand why. And Channel 4 News and a lot of our London media seem to think that it's okay to overthrow President Assad.
Absolutely.
Okay, Sue, so thanks very much for that report.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Sue Jones is with me still, and now, Sue, we're going to move on to talk about strokes. Not an easy subject to talk about. Really looking at whether a stroke is a stroke or a fall. How do you tell? Something that happened to you, in fact, on the way home from Bristol on the bus one evening. What happened?
That's right. So I was going on the bus from Bristol to Wells, and it was in the evening, and in the queue was somebody I knew. So we sat next to each other and we talked for the hour. Somebody I don't see very often. And
so in the queue waiting for the bus?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and then
in the
we,
bus station.
In the bus station. Then we sat in the bus and chatted about our daughters, you know, and that sort of thing. And then he got up to ring the bell when we got to Wells. And the next thing I knew, he'd fallen on the seat opposite. And I thought, well, we were on the top deck of the double-decker bus, which kind of rattles along the country roads quite fast. So I thought, oh, well, he's just lost his balance. He got up again and then he fell down twice more. And then he had to be helped down the stairs and kind of sat down on a seat. And the bus driver did exactly the right thing. He stopped the bus. He rang 999. He said, we've got a passenger who's had a fall and, you know, this and that. And they asked him a few questions and he answered them, I think. Okay, so we were all sitting there, and about a quarter of an hour went past, no sign of the ambulance. And we were starting to think, we were looking at this man's right arm and leg, and they weren't doing much. And we were thinking, now, was this concussion or is it a stroke? We didn't know. So another passenger rang up 999 and said, you know, is the ambulance coming? And they couldn't give us any assurance that an ambulance
was
coming.
So you were out in the middle of nowhere, or were you in the middle of Wells?
We were just at the beginning of Wells.
Oh, okay, so you were at least in Wells, so yeah. You wouldn't have thought it was going to take too long.
No, you wouldn't, exactly, you wouldn't have thought so. So she rang up and they went through the same sort of questions. Is he, you know, is he conscious? Yes. Is he breathing? Yes. Is he bleeding? No. Is he injured? No. Not as far as we could see, you see. And she said, you know, we don't know if it's concussion or a stroke. And they still couldn't give any thing of saying an ambulance is on its way, which would have been reassuring. So then another 5 or 10 minutes went past. And then I made the third phone call and I said, look, we do think now it might be a stroke. And it's very important, isn't it, to get people to hospital as soon as possible after a stroke. So then the call handler, you know, got on board with it being a stroke and said, and well, asked me the questions, the key questions.
Well, hang on, because, I mean, you had suggested that it could have been a stroke from the symptoms you'd given in the first place. So surely they should have asked you that.
Well,
quite early on.
The second call, I think the other passenger mentioned it, but they didn't kind of get onto that. And I sort of pushed it, and then they asked me the three key questions, which are, when he's ask him to smile, and if, can he smile with all his face or is it only with one side? And then the second thing was, can he raise both his arms above his head? And the third thing was, could he repeat some sort of tongue twister? So he didn't really smile at all. I'm not sure that he was really understanding what we were asking, but he did try to raise one arm, but he couldn't raise his right arm at all. And then he couldn't say anything, you know, understandably. So then they realised that it was a stroke, and, you know, and then within about 5 minutes the ambulance appeared. But, you know, we were concerned about the delay. And that just led me to think, well, I wonder, you know, it's a bit worrying, isn't it, when this kind of thing happens?
Half an hour it took altogether,
yes,
to get an ambulance there.
Yeah.
That's a long time. So do they don't send an ambulance out to everyone. So do you think maybe they weren't sending an ambulance? It was only once three calls had been made and you'd been pushing them to say, well, look, we think this might be a stroke, even though, of course, you're not doctors. You can't really diagnose that, that they actually did send an ambulance. Did you manage to work out from the paramedics what happened?
I've tried to work it out, but I've been looking on the websites and how they code these calls. I think in the olden days, when you dialed 999 and asked for an ambulance, they had to send an ambulance. But quite often it turned out to, well, not quite often, but sometimes it turned out to be very trivial. So they decided to be a bit smarter about it and sort of do telephone triage. And what that works out at is that the most life-threatening, urgent things are coded as red. So there's red one, which is when, like, somebody's not breathing or there's no pulse, they've had a severe heart attack. So that's red one. They need to get the ambulance with the blue flashing lights there as soon as possible. If it's red two, it's still serious, it's still life-threatening, but not quite as urgent. And one of the things that comes under red two is a suspected stroke with serious symptoms, which is what this turned out to be. And other things are like epileptic fits when the patient's unconscious. So it should by rights have been coded as a red two if they'd picked up that it was a stroke.
I'm just wondering, though, I mean, did they ask you quite earlier on whether he could speak or not?
No.
That's a very basic thing to ask, isn't it?
They didn't
go
into those
questions.
That
would be a really sort of, you know, almost anybody, they've had a fall, they're injured, they can't get up. I mean, can they speak? I would have thought that's a very basic question that needs to be asked.
Absolutely. And I'm not trying to sort of throw brick bats at them here, but it did make me wonder. I wonder how these are coded, and I wonder, because the thing is, for the calls that aren't coded red, they're coded green, and there's four different grades of green, but basically one and two, they're still serious, but they're not life-threatening. So that's like when you fall and you have got an injury, you've broken your bones or you're bleeding. Or the less serious ones, which are green three and four, where you've fallen but there's no injury, that sort of thing. And what worries me is that the questions they were asking made it sound like it was a fall with no injuries, which could have resulted in the ambulance only being sent within the hour, or possibly even just getting a phone call from a doctor to sort of run things through rather than the blue flashing lights.
Well, the guy can't speak and he can't stand up. So, I mean, he's not going home, is he, in a hurry?
No. So.
But they hadn't worked that out from what the questions that they'd asked on the other end of the 999.
No. So that was a bit worrying. And
because you do really rely on the person at the other end to ask the right questions, because very few people that dial 999 are actually professional doctors and know how the right questions to ask about a particular case.
Absolutely. I tell you what, I'll know the questions next time. And something that comes out of it for me is that if anybody has a fall that seems anything more than just a minor one, I would, you know, advise everybody, go through these things yourself. Can they smile with their whole mouth? Can they raise both arms above their shoulders? Can they understand what you're saying and repeat something back to you clearly? And if they can't do, the NHS advice is, if they can't do even one of those things, ring 999 and ask for an ambulance and say, you know, I think this might be a stroke because they're fast positive. The three tests are known as fast. Face weakness, arm weakness, and speech problems, FAS, and then T, get on the phone and ring them up. Just to let you know, I did try and get hold of the Ambulance Trust, who referred me to the National NHS Digital Pathways, because the Ambulance Trust works by flowcharts that come from the NHS nationally. And they did say that within the clinical pathway used to assess falls, there are questions which specifically address symptoms of a stroke. So really, the questions should have been asked, but for whatever reason, they weren't.
Well, let me guess what that reason might be, because the entire Great Western Ambulance Trust and Somerset, wherever we're talking about here, it's in Wales, isn't it? Trust is overstretched, and they're looking to not send people if at all possible.
I really wouldn't like to throw that at them. I wouldn't like to say, and it's the South West Ambulance Trust, not the Great Western Ambulance Trust.
Okay.
Not been taken over by the train company yet. No, but certainly one of the things, when I looked through their report, I think back in August, one of the things there is it notes with concern the high staff turnover. So one in six of the staff have left, presumably within the last year. And so there is a problem with morale and pressure of work, I think.
Yes, no good, is it? Rubbish leadership, whoever's running it, I'm afraid. They've also moved, haven't they? Here in Bristol, they've gone from a purpose-built, all bells and whistles headquarters right next to Castle Park, just to the south of Castle Park. In fact, that whole place has now been sold off, bulldozed, and they've been put onto an industrial estate in Lawrence Hill somewhere. So I don't know if people have been around that area, but you can see ambulances driving in and out of this industrial estate. So I think that's an appalling thing for morale, and whoever's in charge of that, I think, should be sacked immediately. I don't know who they are. But if you're going to play around with the way that the ambulance service works in the city, and you're going to dent the morale of the paramedics, then that's obviously going to affect patient care in some way.
Well, who am I to say? I can't accuse them of getting it wrong, but all I'm saying is it took half an hour for whatever reason, and it could have been crucial, that half an hour.
Anyway, I suppose the final thing is, do you know how your friend is?
Well, he's still in hospital. He's still finding it difficult to speak. It was a major stroke, and he's not.
So, actually, the fact that they took such a long time to get there could have been one of the reasons why he's still in hospital, because I know that by getting there quickly, you can do something about strokes a lot of the time.
You can. They do this thrombolysis thing, I think, which they did do with him, but the type of stroke he had actually didn't respond to that. So I don't think it actually made him worse in this case.
That's very good. But, I mean, let's just remind listeners how long it actually took the ambulance to arrive after he'd had the initial fall again.
Half an hour.
Well, let's hope that they can get it better next time.
Another fact I found in the NHS website about strokes is that a quarter of strokes kill people. So, you know what I mean? They do, you know, they're very serious things. And the other thing, this was fascinating, I was talking to a friend and she said her husband had had a mini stroke. And she said just briefly he had the symptoms of not being able to smile, not being able to speak and not being able to raise one arm. But it passed and went. But luckily they contacted, I think, 999. And what that was, it was like an early warning sign. And although it went and he was perfectly all right afterwards, what that meant is they started to give him treatment, which should prevent now a major stroke happening. So it could have saved his life, the fact that he had a minor one that they recognised. So, you know, be on alert.
Okay, and just take us through those checks again that you should do if you suspect that someone is having a stroke.
So it's the FAST test, F-A-S-T. F for face, facial problems. Particularly the smile. If somebody only smiles with like half the mouth and the other just still drops, then that's one of the signs. A is arm weakness. So that means the one arm, certainly they won't be able to lift if they've had a stroke. And S is speech problems. They won't be able to speak clearly.
Well, some great wise advice. And so if the person on the other end of the 999 call fails you, that bit of advice might save someone's life, Sue. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect again.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. Okay.
I'm Rich Nyland, a one-time American now living in Germany, and you know, I had a very good idea of what was going to happen in the U.S. election, and it turned out totally different than what I expected. So I'm a little bit shocked. I mean, what I saw happening was I honestly thought Donald Trump was trying to help Hillary Clinton win the election. And the reason for that is that he's been friends of the Clintons for years and years now. You know, he's given them lots of money. They were invited to his wedding. You know, he often would go out to dinner with both Bill. You know, he'd play golf with Bill, but he'd go to dinner with Hillary in the time when she was, a senator in New York. So when he first said he was going to run, you know, what I thought is that this is just another way of him helping, you know, the Clintons, because in the beginning he didn't have the nomination. But what I thought would happen is that they choose another Republican, and then Donald Trump would act like the spoiled brat and say, well, I will then run as a third party candidate. And that would split sort of the conservative vote and put Hillary into the office. And then when he got the nomination, I figured, well, all he has to do now is act like a stupid idiot, and then Hillary will also get in. Well, he did act like a stupid idiot, and he ended up getting in. So I've been proven wrong.
So, I mean, the connections in the past with the Clintons, that's something that hasn't really come out much here in the British media.
Oh, yeah, but it's all there. You can, you know, look it up. He would play golf with Bill Clinton, often had contact with Hillary. He donated lots of money to the Clinton Foundation, and those records are all there. And now all of a sudden, what I was really surprised at is that Donald Trump is saying, you know, this Hillary Clinton is a terrible woman, and he's saying all these bad things about her. So he went from being really good friends with them to absolutely hating the woman. And normally, I would say that if a relationship goes from, you know, very good to very bad, something must have happened. But there's no news that there was ever an event which would cause Donald Trump to not be friends with the Clintons. Yet all of a sudden, you know, they're like the worst enemies. And I thought this is just, you know, an act. They're all actors anyways. We know that. But, you know, I expected that this was just an act to put Hillary into office. And Donald Trump was doing her a good favor. And now the guy wins.
So do you think that'll make any difference? I mean, for example, for relations between Russia and Germany, Russia and Europe, or any other parts of the world?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't think it will make any difference, because it's really a question of who does Trump surround himself with, you know, as his cabinet. And when I see, you know, when he had his victory announcement there, on stage with him was Rudy Giuliani, you know, one of the tools of 9/11. So if that's any sign of who he's going to choose, then you can pretty much be sure he's going to have Goldman Sachs people in there as well. And then the policies aren't going to change.
I mean, Rudy Giuliani has been, we've seen quite a lot of him. He's not been on the TV much for a long time, and then suddenly he's popped up again with Trump. I mean, what can you tell us about what his connection is with the September 11th attacks, and why we might have to be a little bit concerned about that?
Well, he was mayor of New York at the time, and if you look at what was happening in Building 7, I think there's a very good chance that a lot of the organization for the actual attacks was planned out of Building 7. And Giuliani would have known that. And then afterward, he kind of acts like the American hero. He must have known what was going on earlier. in the thing, and therefore I view the man as not trustworthy. And now all of a sudden he's up there celebrating with Donald Trump. Yeah, that's not a good sign.
I mean, do you think this is going to change the foreign policy much, you know, the relations with China, relations with Russia, that kind of thing?
Well, you would think so from what Trump said. You know, he was the one who said that he was going to negotiate with Putin. And it was Hillary Clinton who was saying she was going to build up the troops on the border to Russia. You know, so you would expect there'd be a difference there. But isn't it always the case that, you know, the people voted for change with Barack Obama? Well, they didn't get the change they wanted, did they? And why should it be any different with Donald Trump? I just, you know, I don't have any faith in the system. You know, the same people are running the system as before. They have a different spokesperson now, but not much has changed.
Okay, so there is still hanging around in the background this tension in Syria. There's also the kind of economic financial cliff edge that we're on, which we could go over almost any time. How do you see the next year or couple of years?
Well, I'm a little surprised that Trump got in. You know, I wonder why they didn't let Hillary get in, because Hillary, in my opinion, was really the best choice of Wall Street. It may fit together with this Brexit thing. I didn't expect that, you know, they would allow Brexit to go through either. But they did, and now they let Trump into office as well. I mean, could you imagine if now there's a worldwide economic crisis? Well, then they're going to blame it on Trump, and they're going to blame it on, you know, Brexit and all these nationalistic movements going on in various countries. It could be an effort just to, kill all the motivation going on in these different countries to put everybody back in line.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, for example, in Germany, movements like Pegida, there's also similar movements in other countries like, obviously, Greece, we know well about, but not so many people realise that there's a big movements in Spain and Italy also to secede from Brussels, and in France, of course, but people haven't been given the chance, haven't been given the vote. You think that it may be that the Brexit and Trump might affect whether those movements ever come to fruition?
Well, certainly if things all fall apart and then they can blame, you know, these choices, it will definitely affect the amount of support for, the people in Brussels, for the European Union and all of that. The European Union could turn out even stronger after a crisis. You know, so that is something to think about.
Now, I mean, this isn't a view we're getting in the BBC. This is not a view we're getting on Fox News, any of the mainstream press, Rich. What makes you think that you've got possibly, an insight that some of these top journalists, they call them, across the West don't have?
Well, to be honest with you, I don't see it that way. I'm the person who was totally wrong about the election in the U.S. So... You know, I would certainly question my opinion right now. I mean, I'm still going to speak my opinion, but why, maybe the mainstream media is better than me.
I mean, well, I don't agree, because the mainstream media was pushing all the time for Remain with the Brexit vote and for Hillary with the Clinton. In fact, there was a poll in the New York Times within a week of the presidential election last week saying 87% for Hillary and only 13% of people were going to vote for Trump. Well, they were totally wrong.
Yes, but don't you view that as just a propaganda mechanism? I mean, the press really is been reduced down to the level of propaganda at this point. It's all bought and sold for certain interests. Yeah, so I think that they wanted to get Hillary into office. They certainly didn't want Trump.
Okay, so can I just ask you, almost re-ask you the other question I asked before, is what do you see unfolding over the next year or so?
Well, I'm a little bit nervous about some type of an economic crisis unfolding. I'm not very nervous about, you know, war situations or something. The things in Syria, that's obviously going to continue on. I don't see Trump doing much, you know, different there. You know, I was very concerned about Hillary Clinton getting in, because then that would have been the pushing the start button for a war with Iran. Whereas, you know, I don't see Trump doing that, but, you know, I can be proven wrong again. I'm more nervous about an economic type problem.
And what would that, how would that manifest itself? What would that look like?
Well, if the central banks were to push up the interest rates or something and crash the, you know, world economies, and then they can blame it on isolationism, you know, from the different nationalistic movements, you know, it wouldn't take much in this fragile economy to really, you know, put it in the tank.
It's interesting that Yeah, I mean, it's almost like reverse psychology, isn't it, this whole Trump thing? Maybe it's deliberate, you know, that's what's gone on.
Judge him on what he actually does, and the first thing he's going to do is choose the people he puts around him. And if they're all insiders, then you know what you're going to get. If he happens to pick some people who are really outside the establishment, you know, then I'd actually be, you know, more optimistic that something would happen. It's just, you know, we haven't seen that in my whole lifetime. It's been the same thing over and over again.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our reporter, Sue Jones, and our guest, Vanessa Bealey, also to Rich Nyland from Germany, ex-United States, talking about Trump just then. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897, or at prsc.org.uk online. Also through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or you can go and have a look at the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
To keep clean.
Skyscrapers bloom in America. Cadillacs zoom in America. Industry boom in America.
Wealth in a room in America.
Lots of new housing with more space.
Lots of doors slamming in our face.
I'll get to meant.
Better get rid of your accent.
Life can be bright in America.
If you can fight in America.
Life is all right in America.
If you're all white in America.
As you stay on your own side.
Free to be anything you choose.
Free to wear devils and shine shoes.
Everywhere crime in America. Organized crime in America. Terrible time in America.
You forget I'm in America.
I go back to San Juan.
I know a boat you can get on. Bye-bye.
Everyone there will give big cheers.
Everyone there will have moved here.